The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan and I am honored to introduce our guests. The nation's legal analyst and justice correspondent and a frequent contributor to MSNBC, Ellie Mistal is an Alfred Knobler Fellow at the Type Media Center and the legal editor of More Perfect, Radiolab's podcast about the U.S. Supreme Court. A Harvard Law School graduate and former litigator at Debevoise & Plimpton, he was the executive editor of Above the Law, a news site sharing details and original commentary about the legal profession. Referred to by Malcolm Nance as a tour de force from the explainer-in-chief of American law, Ellie Mistal's new book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, is a series of arguments for the layman about how one of our founding documents should be interpreted in opposition to Republican claims. This evening, he'll be joined in conversation with Danielle M. Conway, Dean and Donald Farage Professor of Law at Penn State Dickinson Law, the first law school established in 1834 in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, one of two separately accredited law schools at Penn State University established in 1834. Dean Conway is an expert in procurement law, entrepreneurship, intellectual property law, and licensing intellectual property. She is the author of numerous books, articles, and essays, and she was formerly the dean of the University of Maine Law and served on the faculties at several other law schools. Please welcome Ellie Mistal and Danielle Conway to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
It's an honor to be here this evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia, an important site where knowledge is conveyed performatively and transformatively through discourse, resistance, contestation, and liberation to engage with the democratic process. Ellie.
What's up?
Thank you for writing this book, Allow Me to Retort, A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution. I'd like you to introduce the theme of the book and what you hope the book will accomplish.
Yeah, well, let's start here because it comes up quite a lot. It's called A Black Guy's Guide to the Constitution, not a guide to the Constitution for black guys, right? And so that's an important distinction, right? Because the goal of the book is to show what the law looks like, what our constitutional law looks like, certainly, but what our general kind of governmental structure looks like from the perspective of a person that structure was designed to ignore and, in fact, enslave. And it looks different, right? It hits different, as the kids would say, when you are reading a document that you know was purposefully designed to erect a Western slave empire. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that document is good, how we should interpret that document, what's going on in the kind of nether regions of that document, kind of become more important, right? Like, and then we'll talk later about the amendments and all this kind of stuff. But at a fundamental level, what I like to make the analogy: it's like the Constitution is like a Ford Focus, right? Mm-hmm. And then after, we had some wars, we had some idea. So we kind of stole the hubcaps off of Cadillac. And this is like, it's a Cadillac now. No, it ain't. Mm-hmm. It's still a Ford. I can still tell by the engine that it's a Ford Focus. Now, it could get us to where we're going, potentially. Like, it's not necessarily, I'm not saying that it's a car that has no utility. Mm-hmm. But let's be honest about what this thing is, right? And so that's the perspective of the book, to kind of have an honest look at the Constitution from the perspective of somebody that it was designed to ignore. It's labor of it was really just trying to take a lot of thoughts and ideas that I've had throughout the process of myself becoming educated, right, throughout law school and my practice and my coverage of the law, and try to distill that into its most essential forms. Because almost every chapter in this book kind of started with me saying, like in law school, let's say, what the is that? Like, what? How is that? And you know, a professor going, well, you know, we have to understand that what James Madison was trying to, like, why do I care? And a lot, and kind of distilling those kind of conversations and rejections into kind of book form.
Well, I love the idea that this is a constitutional law casebook. Number one.
Don't say that. People won't buy it when you say that. It is an exciting political takedown.
It really is. It really is. But you do it with such conciseness and brevity. But I sat with the title of the book a bit. I really did, and I'm glad you mentioned that. As I read it, I got the distinct sense that you are guiding the reader through what are often convoluted provisions of and elided meanings of the United States Constitution. And I quickly understood you to be centering Black voices, minoritized voices, subordinated and oppressed voices. You provide in this work a compelling example, many examples, of how the U.S. Constitution as a founding document is by design exclusive and oppressive. Please critique the U.S. Constitution for us tonight.
Yeah, so as you might have heard me say, you might know me from... Right. Saying on television that the Constitution is kind of trash. Because it's kind of trash. Like, literally, the first line of the book is, the Constitution is not good. The last line of the book, I'll save you the trouble. The last line of the book is, the Constitution is trash. It's conservatives who say that it always has to be, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, the very frame of the book is that this document is not good. Why? Well, I don't know. It seems to me that the deal made by white slavers, white colonists, and rich white abolitionists who were who were still willing to deal with slavers and colonists doesn't represent the best that we can do as a society. Maybe that's not our highest bet, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a fairly obvious point, right? Mm-hmm. The Constitution is a deal-making document, right? And what the deal was supposed to do was, yes, set up a Republican form of government where you had essentially local control and weren't ruled by a king across the sea. That was a big part of it. But it was also to set up an economic empire based on slave labor that could never be undone. And so a key thing that happens, and you see this a lot in conservative media, where they now try to gaslight people and act as if the very slavers who wrote the Constitution put in a poison pill, put in some kind of secret deal to eventually unpack slavery in due time. No. No, they put in various things that would make it almost impossible to ever unpack slavery. And you know how I can prove that? We had a war! Like, the Constitution was so broken upon release that not only did it need a day one patch, not only did it need the Bill of Rights that we know as the first 10 amendments to just fix things that were obviously wrong with it in its initial inception, it was so broken that we could not come to a peaceable solution to the slavery question. We had to literally fight a civil war. Mm-hmm. And then after we fought that war, it was still so broken, after we amended it and whatever, that white people were able to ignore those amendments for about 100 years. Mm-hmm. And then we had to have another civil uprising to fix, to make good on the promises that we had a war to. So that, I count that as strike two against the Constitution, right? Then okay, fine, we have the Civil Rights Movement, we have the Voting Rights Act, things seem to go better. We have about 40 years of, like, pretty good progress, arc of history bending towards. You know, in 40 years, you go from, like, an oppressed people to the first Black president. That's a pretty good, we did some pretty good thing, right? And how do white people react to that? Mm. They are so mad at that, they kicked the Black president out, replaced him with a bigoted orange con man, and when that con man lost, he launched a coup. Mm-hmm. That's our Constitution. That's strike three as far as I'm
you
concerned.
Summed it up, but I'm going to roll back. Okay. I'm going to roll back. So let's roll back to those Reconstruction Amendments.
Yeah.
And let's,
the good ones. And we tried.
The
Yay.
Good ones. The second founding. Let's insert in there the role of the United States Supreme Court in actually limiting the 14th Amendment.
So I wanted to say two things about the Reconstruction Amendments. Three things. Number one, great. Great. Should have done that in the first place. Those are real good, you know, no slavery and equality for all and voting rights for it, but not men, not women, just men, because even at the time, they were still sexist bastards. And that's the point, right? Because even in the after a war that you fight over equality, the people who get to write the amendments granting freedom to the formerly enslaved race are still white guys. They still, even at that moment, did not go and ask the formerly enslaved people or the free black people. They didn't ask, I mean, think about it this way. They didn't ask Frederick Douglass what the amendment should read that gave people freedom. Why wouldn't you ask him? I would have. I would have let him write the damn thing. And lest you think that this is a non-important issue, imagine the kinds of rights the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments might have conferred had they actually asked the slaves, the former slaves, what they thought full and equal rights looked like. They might have added not just equal protection under the law and an equal right to vote, they might have added an equal right to housing. That might have been a thing. They might have added economic rights, so not just the right to work their land, but the right to be paid fairly for the work they've done, equal work for equal pay. And obviously, had they asked women at that time, which none of them did, women might have said, like, oh, I'd like to finish my goddamn sentence. That's what I just want in the Constitution. Women can finish her sentences. That could have been the 16th Amendment, right? So even in these amendments that, like, made things better, it was still fundamentally a rich white male version of freedom and whatever. And then we get to the Supreme Court's role in it, which has been to limit the effectiveness of those Reconstruction amendments at every turn. And again, this is an important lesson for liberals. There, even an amendment, even something as momentous as a constitutional amendment, cannot survive conservatives on the Supreme Court. And we have proof of that, right? We have proof of the Supreme Court just ignoring the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause when it came to segregation. Just straight up, just didn't care. Completely ignoring the 15th Amendment's right to vote. Just putting it in a drawer. Again, 400 years after an amendment that was, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 guys, white guys again, on the Supreme Court who did that for hundreds of years in the face of an amendment. The very first case, the very first Supreme Court case, I talk about this in the book, after the passage of the Reconstruction Amendment were called the Slaughterhouse Cases, it was white people arguing for their rights under the 13th and 14th Amendments because they were like literally slaughterhouse workers, and the government granted a monopoly to some rich white guy slaughterhouse, and the poor white guys were like, hey! That seems like indentured servitude. That seems like a lack of equal protection. And the Supreme Court was like, shut up. So right there out of the gate, for white people, they would not think expansively about what these amendments could do. And that's the constant struggle that we have in this country. The best law, the best amendment, the best ideas at every point can be overturned by 5 white people on the Supreme Court.
Excellent. So here's a question, and I'm going to shift gears. Anyone who knows me knows I'm a big fan of profanity. So I really like that. Especially when strategically deployed. So I think it breaks tension. I think it brings humor to the conversation. But I really want to know what you think. Why are profanity and snarky humor critical to this discussion?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, I'm talking about law, and, you know, I need people to wake up, right? Like, that's just, like, if you talk about law in a monotone voice, people will start to drift. And you got to, like, shock them out of their just, you know, complacency. I understand whether I'm writing an article for The Nation or if I'm writing a book, I understand that it's a huge ask, right? You people have, like, lives and, like, stuff to do, right? You know, bills to pay. And I'm like, time out. Wait, I have a thought. Everybody stop. I have a thought. You should read these thoughts because they're good thoughts. Like, so that's a huge ask. So like, if I'm not giving some entertainment value while I'm making that huge ask, that's just like bad job by me, right? So that's number one, just I'm just trying to get people into the stories that I'm trying to tell. But the second point is that, you know, it again, one of the reasons why I think there's such asymmetry in fighting about the law is that the conservatives are always willing to put their legal theories in the most simplest, basic terms. Mm-hmm. So if you think about like a conservative, a base conservative voter, I don't think a base MAGA person is any smarter than a base liberal person. You're not going to make me believe that. I just don't think that, right? But the conservative leaders do a one-to-one connection. So they tell their MAGA people, you know, if you don't like those men kissing on each other, you got to have the Supreme Court. You know, if you want to have your gun so you can shoot Negroes that show up in your town, you got to have the Supreme Court. And they're, I got to have the Supreme Court, right? They don't know. They don't know civics. They don't know anything more than any other average people. But the conservatives have made a one-to-one connection, right? We, the liberals, do not make that one connection. We don't make that one-to-one connection of, do you want anything to ever happen with the environment? Like anything, then you have to have the Supreme Court. Do you want anything to happen with gun regulation? You want anything to happen with police reform? Then you have to have the Supreme Court. We don't make that one-to-one connection, and we don't put it in ways that people can understand. Mm-hmm. The law is complicated, sure, but it is not rocket science. It is not heart surgery. My wife is a structuring products lawyer. Her job is complicated. Mm-hmm. My job is not, right? The problem is that lawyers tend to use a lot of jargon, use a lot of inside baseball terminology to kind of make themselves sound smart and sound like an expert, and I really know what strict scrutiny, right? No, and I'm trying to like just put it where everybody can understand it. Not dumb it down, because that doesn't help anybody, but put it in ways that people can understand and appreciate these concepts, because I honestly believe that if everybody understood it, everybody would fight for it,
right?
Because it's awful what they do.
Right. You know, I'm going to ask you now to actually read chapter 7 of your book on the heels of that response about accessibility of language and constitutional provisions. And the reason I want you to read chapter 7, not because it is concise, which is what you're getting at, but Ellie, it spoke to me when I read it as the black mother of a black son, who is 10 years old, and who I guard with every fiber in my being.
All right. Well, it's the shortest chapter, so there's that, so don't worry.
There is that.
All right. Stopping police brutality. There's a scene from the first Austin Powers movie. Mike Myers' Dr. Evil character is executing his elaborate plot to kill Austin Powers. It's a spoof of the movie trope, where the bad guy makes an unnecessarily complicated contraption for killing the hero, which the hero predictably escapes. Dr. Evil's son, Scott, played hilariously by Seth Green, questions the plan. He could get away. I have a gun in my room. You give me 5 seconds, I'll get it, I'll come back down here, boom, I'll blow his brains out. Of course, Dr. Evil ignores him. You just don't get it, do you, Scott? And that's the joke, right? To make the movie work, it can never be that simple. Script writers of action movies have to devise convoluted plans of villainy so that it seems plausible for the protagonist to escape. I hope people can see that we could stop police brutality in 5 seconds if we wanted to. It's really not that complicated. The last 3 chapters of the book, which you'll have to read for yourselves, point the way through the Constitution as already written to end the scourge of police violence against black people. The 4th Amendment does all the work. Here's the text. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Boom! Make stopping people because they're black an unreasonable search. Make shooting people because they're black an unreasonable seizure. Make shall not be violated include actually prosecuting cops and holding them personally accountable when they violate these principles. The way to fix the police was written in our Constitution before there were even police in need of fixing. People, you have to remember, the police are a relatively recent invention in American history. The unnecessary destruction of black lives would stop, not all at once, but over time, as cops learn to play by the rules that have always been there. They'd adjust their behavior. At the margins, sure, there'd still be some close cases, situations where the suspect really did have a weapon and really was threatening the police or others. There would still be times when reasonable, unbiased people disagreed about whether the police tried to de-escalate the situation, and those close cases would and those tough cases would still be resolved in favor of the police officer. But applying the Fourth Amendment, as I suggest, would make the police officers think twice before killing black children. It would make officers hesitate before brutalizing unarmed black teens who pose no credible threat to the officer. It would make the police liable for shooting black people in the back. Cops who continue to be racist would risk jail or poverty. And that risk, that threat of accountability, is what is needed. Black lives can only matter if there is a punishment for the people who take them. There, I've solved it. I've solved police brutality in America. Please tell me where I can arrive in Oslo to accept my Nobel Peace Prize. Of course, we won't be implementing the Fourth Amendment as I suggest, and I won't be getting my $1,145,000. I looked it up. Just in case. Because white people want the police to act this way. They want them violent and unshackled from constitutional restraint. Maybe not all white people all the time, but enough of them most of the time. I can't stop police brutality, not because it's difficult to stop, but because too many white people in America want the police to be brutal. I point specifically to Amy Cooper, the Central Park Karen, as she's come to be known. Amy Cooper got into an argument with bird watcher Chris Cooper, no relation, because Chris asked her to leash her dog as Central Park rules require. Chris Cooper happens to be black while Amy Cooper is white. Amy threatened to call the cops on Chris, and then she did just that, alleging in a faux hysterical voice, "A black man was attacking me in the park." In that moment, Amy Cooper was asking the cops to show up and enforce the supremacy of her whiteness. She was in the wrong. Who the hell calls the cops when they're the ones in violation of a city ordinance? A white person does that. A white person who knows that the cops are there to protect her privilege, not enforce the law and keep the peace. Most white people I know like to think of themselves as better than Amy Cooper. Most of them tell me they were disgusted by her actions and would never call the cops like she did, or any number of so-called Karens have been shown to do in this era of the camera phone. But most of them are lying. Most of them are reacting negatively to Amy Cooper's application of her privilege and not the underlying concept on which it rests. Most white people want there to be somebody to call when they feel threatened by blackness. Sure, many will use that power more judiciously than Amy Cooper, but they want the power nonetheless. And frankly, many of those who don't want the police to be at their beck and call to deal with perceived threats from black people are the ones who are concealing firearms to handle any threats themselves in the name of self-defense. As I've explained in a previous chapter, even the way that we apply the legal concept of self-defense in this country is inextricably linked with white violence done unto black people. So while police brutality and violence only gets talked about as a black issue, make no mistake, it's a problem entirely created by and for the benefit of white people. I don't hold personal enmity towards the cops, towards the police, any more than I hold a personal grudge against a pack of dogs sent to recapture me after I escaped from bondage. My issue is with their owner. My issue is with white people who refuse to keep their goddamn cops on a leash. There are no good or bad cops. There are just shitty white people. Man, that was harsh.
Yeah, and you know, riff off of that a little bit, because we often think that systemic problems are individual racial problems, but these systemic problems are the ones that keep black bodies in danger.
So there are two things that I want to expound on here, right? One is this concept of some white people, but not all white people. And a lot of white people get pissed off when I say that. And the reason why I say most white people is because I can see how they vote. The Democratic candidate for president has lost the white popular vote in every presidential election since the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Folks, that's not a phase, right? That's not randomness because, oh, I didn't like that candidate, but I did. You know, Barack Obama lost the white vote, all right? Hillary Clinton lost the white vote. Whoever ran against Nixon that I'm forgetting right now, Humphrey lost the white, because there were like 18 people who were trying. And Humphrey lost the white vote. Like everyone since the passage of the Civil Rights Act has lost the white vote. Why? Why? And that's what, so when I say a majority of white people, I'm talking about those majority of white voters that show up again and again and again and again. Yes, we have a minority of white people with us. Great, welcome to the party, right? Being a minority of my whole life, I welcome you. I think that's awesome. But you have to understand where the real pushback is coming from, right? So the other thing that's worth, so that's, you know, one kind of big thing that I always get pushback on, and I am happy to have a chance to explain that a little bit more. The other kind of big thing that I get that we have to talk about when we talk about cops is that, like, the... That's what I'm looking for.
I think we were talking about the abolish versus...
Yeah, like, the... I would not consider myself a police abolitionist, right? Which is weird, I think, for people who tend to paint me as a particular radically... disposed person. I'm not a police abolitionist, not because I think cops are good or because cops have been used appropriately or whatever, but because we haven't tried holding them accountable. It's just never been done before. Now, the abolitionist will say to me, it's never been done because it can't be done. And I say, that's an interesting point if it had been tried, but it hasn't been tried, so let's at least try once. We have never lived a day in this country where cops were prosecuted by an independent third party as opposed to the DA that they are buddies with to stop other crime. We've just never tried it, right? We never tried taking away qualified immunity from cops, right? Right. That just opens them up to private lawsuits, but like I say in the book, like, you threaten a white person being poor, Maybe we hesitate a little bit more. Maybe the decision to gun down an unarmed youth hits a little bit differently if they know that if they screw up, they could be sued in their private property, right? And then the third thing is my idea about having an objective use of force. Like, right now, all a cop has to say is, I think he had a gun. Doesn't actually have to have a gun. It could be a cell phone. It could be a hair pick. It could be, right? So I just say, let's make the standard objective. If you shoot somebody because you think they have a gun, they better have a gun. And if they don't have a gun, you go to jail. Not, oh, I thought it could have been. No, we hold you to a higher standard. If you're going to shoot somebody to death because you think they have a gun, you best be sure. Because if you're not, you go to jail, because that's what would happen to anybody else. Right? I can't come home and see a person, you know, like rummaging through my trash and shoot them in the back of the head being like, oh, I thought it was a gun when it was actually like a lightsaber. Like, I can't do that. So why wouldn't you hold the police to the same high standard? We haven't tried that. And so that's why I'm not a police abolitionist, because I think that we haven't actually tried holding these people accountable. That's why I'm using the leash analogy in the book. We haven't tried putting these people on a leash. You know, and I use the dog analogy a lot because I love dogs, right? There are no bad dogs. Like, all dogs, right? There are just bad owners.
Yeah, and it's reform versus abolition.
Right. I could be wrong. I mean, the abolitionists make a good point. I could be wrong, but I think that it's worth it to try. But then the last thing I'll say about this is that when people then say, like, oh, but the abolition, it's a bad slogan. We don't like the slogan. Defund the police is bad. Like, okay, well, then give me your slogan, right? Because what we can't do is pretend like there's no problem, right? And that's where I think having the sons comes in. Like, my, you know, I've got a 9-year-old who's, like, super sweet. He's, like, he's a pleaser, which is a problem. He's a bit of a manipulator, because it's a problem. But he's a sweet kid. He likes to dance poorly and, you know, make bad jokes and all this kind of sweet little kid stuff. And when do I take it away from him?
Right.
When do I reach into his life and tell him, no, you can't run up and hug that person. No, you have to, you can't run. Are you kidding me? Run in a store and fall into some white person and see what happens to you? No. It got taken away from me when I was 13. We were playing, you know, grew up in a black neighborhood. As my parents kind of did better, we moved to a white neighborhood, as one does, I suppose. And so I'm at this white friend's house, and we're playing ball, and you hit the ball over the fence, and it's into, like, the mean guy's yard. It's like one of those guys out of, like, Field of Dreams, where, like, this super mean neighbor guy with a big dog. And so nobody wants to go get the ball, so we have one ball. We draw straws or sticks to get the ball. I drew the small stick, hop the fence, go get the ball, run away from the dog, everything's fine, finish the game. Parents pick me up. How's your day? Both my mom and my dad are in the car. I'm explaining to them, and then I hop this person's fence, and... like, dad hits the brake. My mom goes, oh, Lord, honey, he gonna get shot. like just has like a breakdown, right? And I'm like, what is this? And they just like, you can never do that.
Right.
But I drew the lost straw. I don't care what straw you draw. I don't. You with all these white boys, and you, not even in your neighborhood, and you're gonna go hop some white man's fence for a ball, son. You will never go to that person's house without 10 balls. All right. I'll buy you another. But you're never hopping that. And you have to make your friends understand that you just won't play along.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really like, you know, at first, I thought my dad was, you know, like, okay, father.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody needs a scotch tonight. Like, you know. But, like, you know, you come to realize that you understand why he was making that point.
Yeah.
When do I have to do that to my kid?
Yeah.
Soon.
And as I said, as a black woman with a black child, and I'm a large bone woman, so you can imagine my 10-year-old is huge. Mm. The bigger that he gets, the more I have to protect
That's him. Something that, in my travels, I find that white families don't understand, that black families implicitly understand. It's not about the age of our kids. It's about the height.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the size. Once they're big, we have to start treating them like they're adults, regardless of what age they happen to be, because that's how society is going to treat them, and that's how they're going to have to interact.
And regardless of what gender.
Yep.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, your girls are not protected. You don't have the girl protection that white girls have. No, they just don't.
Yeah, so before this gets away from me, we will have time for you to ask questions. That's awesome, though. Thank you, sir. So,
I don't have any questions. We're just agreeing with each other.
Exactly. It's just I hear amens in the audience. So, let me ask this question. How do we use this second founding of the Reconstruction Amendments plus the 19th Amendment? So how do we use the second founding to strip the veneer from the founding document so as to expose the hypocrisy of cancel culture, the right to bear arms for self-defense, racial profiling, or the subordination of women and the oppression of people who identify as LGBTQ, for example?
Yeah, so having said that, I'm not overly impressed with the second founding, because there are other ways to go. For instance, you know, the South African example, you know, when Nelson Mandela, you know, he gets out of prison, and Matt Damon wins a rugby match, and now he's president and everything is great. What did they take their apartheid Afrikaans constitution and just like put on some amendments? No, they threw that in the trash. Mm-hmm. They threw it in the trash and they started over with a whole new constitutional convention made from all the people, including women. And right now, the South African constitution, just on the world stage, one of the best. Just one of the best written constitution there is out there in terms of the protection of individual rights and such things. It's a great document. Better than ours. Oh, well. Fine. We got what we got, and I don't want a new constitutional convention because it'll just lock in a lot of the same racism that we have today because of the unequal, because we still are focused on land as opposed to people. So I would have a constitutional convention if there would be like 58 delegates from California and one from Wyoming. But you know, it wouldn't work like that, so can't be for a constitutional convention. So instead what I do is I say, you know what? It's fine. I only need two things to write a good to have a good constitution. The 14th Amendment and parts of the First Amendment. But the rest, I can do everything else that I need to do with the 14th Amendment and the First. Because the 14th Amendment says right there that you have equal protection of laws and due process, and we interpret that to be substantive due process. That means real fairness as opposed to mere procedural fairness. Substantive fairness and equal protection. That's all I need. And then, you know, probably shouldn't beat people because they talk. All right, fine.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's it. And I can write that because it does everything else. So I call, you know, people say like, oh, you, what's the opposite of originalism? I call myself a 14th Amendment ologist guy, right? Just because everything that I do would be strained through. Does this law meet equal protection? Is this law substantively fair?
Mm-hmm.
You answer me those two questions and you can have your law. If those fail, either of those questions, for any reason, then that law is no good. Is it equal protection? Is it substantively fair? Those are the only questions that matter for any new law on the books. And if you meet those two, then you can have it. Then it's a political debate.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, it's not a political debate. It's a issue of fundamental justice and fairness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a political question. It's a question of who we are as a society. And as a society, I'm always trying to get us to a point where we are substantively fair and have equality for all. It's not actually that hard of a standard, right? It's not actually that. It's like one of the things that I always kind of understand with the gay rights, with the people who are against the gay rights movement. It's like, you don't have to get gay married. You understand that, right? You could just marry a woman if you don't want to marry a man. You could just do that and leave these people alone. Like, what's the problem, right? The idea that we kind of can't understand the mere concept of kind of live and let live, of letting other people do what seems best to them in the privacy of their own minds and the privacy of their own bedrooms, it's just constantly shocking to me, right? I talk about in the book, like, you know, the baker who with the cake, and he doesn't want to do the cake, and nobody's asking you to jump out of the cake, bro. Right? Nobody said, I love cake. Nobody says, yeah, just you went into business to make cakes. Take money. Take money that these people are giving you for your business. How is that a crime?
You don't even write anything on a wedding cake.
Right? Just. So, or you could say, like, I will not write something on my cake. Okay, fine.
You're
just
right.
Give me the cake. I'll put my own groom and groom on it, and you can take your money and go home. And but no, we have to have a literal federal case over this bigoted baker.
Okay,
Sorry.
Take it down. So I want to give you what I think is a really good word for who you are. So we know Frederick Douglass was a woman's rights man.
Was he? I like to think of him just as a reader, right?
That's what he said. That's what they said. But I think you're a Reconstruction man. So I think that actually gives some heft to your 14th Amendment.
Well, you know, the Reconstruction was great. We saw one of the we had black participation in government. We were arcing towards goodness during Reconstruction, and then Rutherford B. Hayes had a contested election. It was the Electoral College tie, so it went to Congress to secure his election. He was a Republican. He needed votes from Southern Democrats. They gave him the votes in exchange for him taking the troops out of the South. And Rutherford did. That ended Reconstruction, and the South basically went back to its Confederate ways, and which is where we find them today in so many, right, in so many ways. Like it, like the difference between Missouri today and Missouri in 1880 and Missouri in 1850 are not all that different.
It's not that different.
Not all that different. So. You know, what we see in this country is that white Southerners have not been willing to accept freedom and equality unless their white northern cousins are shoving it down their throat with guns. Like, that just, you had to do it in the Civil War. You had to do it in Reconstruction. For Ruby Bridges to go to school, she needed an armed goddamn guard. Right? Like, if you don't have force, they won't accept it. And it's something that's kind of a constant problem with our constitutional structure. I always say that, you know, Republicans and conservatives, they take constitutional setbacks. Sorry, they take constitutional losses as mere setbacks, right? As a mere, like, temporary, like, you know, we lost that battle, but we're going to win the war. And, you know, they never stop coming, even when they lose. They never stop trying.
Right. So I'm going to ask one last question, even though I have so many, because I want to give the audience members an opportunity to speak with you. I have a keen interest in the Reconstruction Amendments plus the 19th Amendment, all in context. Specifically, I've taught a class called Women's Suffrage, the 19th Amendment, and the Duality of a Movement to students and to lawyers. These consumers of the course are always surprised to learn that the 19th Amendment did not facilitate access to voting for black women at the time of its ratification in 1920. Instead, black women were made to wait 45 more years to have the fundamental badge of citizenship recognized by the Voting Rights Act of 65. Here's the question. Why is this important context to know for current discussions about voter suppression, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, and the SCOTUS nomination of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson?
So the Voting Rights Act is my pick for the most important piece of legislation in American history, bar none. I don't think it's close. Because, as I said, the conservatives ignored the 15th Amendment for 100 years. They ignored the 19th Amendment as it applied to women of color for 50 years. Without a law, without a statute that makes the amendments enforceable, a constitutional amendment is just like a suggestion. right? So, like, after the Civil War, it was a suggestion that we let people vote regardless of race, in the same way that, like, after Prohibition, it was a suggestion that we stop people from drinking. It was the Volstead Act that made Prohibition a thing. Similarly, it was the Voting Rights Act that made the 15th Amendment a thing, and it was wildly successful. Not only is it the most important piece of legislation in American history, I could also make an argument that is the most successful piece of legislation in American history. And again, I point simply to the election of a black president 40 years after it was passed, which is an amazing trajectory, just an amazing trajectory, right? So what did white conservatives do? They took away the 15th Amendment by cutting away the Voting Rights Act before that black president was even done with his term. 2013, John Roberts and Shelby County v. Holder eviscerates Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, Section 5 is the section that had that made basically you had to ask for federal permission before you changed your voting rights laws. That was so universally accepted that not only had it been re-ratified in 2006 by George W. Bush, noted not carer of black people. But it was also, you figure, Ronald Reagan, who started his campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which is Mississippi burning territory, for those in the know, and had said the Voting Rights Act humiliates the South, which I'm cool with, but arguably he meant that as a bad thing. He had to expand the Voting Rights Act. But John Roberts, an unelected, unaccountable person, was able to take it away in 2013, and it's just been rolling since then. In 2021, we have Brnovich v. Arizona. They eviscerate, Roberts and Alito this time, eviscerate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. All of the voting, the attacks on democracy that we see now in our news, those did not come from Donald Trump. I know he's the bad guy that the media wants to say. Those did not come from Donald Trump. They came from John Roberts. It is John Roberts who is the actual enemy. He's the guy behind the curtain who has pulled the strings to eviscerate our voting protections so that an orange buffoon like Donald Trump can then, and his Gestapo jackboot people can, I don't want to call them Gestapo. I just want to call them, I don't want to give them that level, right? Right. Just jackboot idiot people.
Right.
That's why they've had this opening, because John Roberts set the scene for them. If you don't control, I guess I come back to, if you don't control the courts, you don't control anything. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act, great idea. The Freedom to Vote Act, not as good as H.R. 1, but still fine. Yay, let's do that. But what makes Democrats think that those things are going to matter? John Roberts ain't going anywhere, and he's got more help now than he did in 2013. If you don't take back the courts, you aren't taking back anything. They'll pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, even if they had Manchin and Sinema, they'd pass it and Roberts would knock it down before breakfast. They'd pass the Freedom to Vote Act and Samuel Alito would knock it down before breakfast. You have to take back the court in order to have voting rights, and that's always been true since even the passage of the 15th Amendment.
Thank you. So please raise your hands. We have a question right here in the front.
What got you to go to Debevoise Plimpton?
So the question was, what got you
what
to
got
go
me
to Debevoise,
Debevoise and Plimpton? So for those in the know, so Debevoise is was a white shoe Manhattan law firm, which was where I worked right out of law school. What got me to go there? Money. Right? Like, I was, you gotta understand, like, also, I was not the first person in my family to go to college, not the first person in my family to go to graduate school. I was very lucky in that sense. But Debevoise, so, yeah, I bring that up to say that when Debevoise offered me my first year salary, that was more money than either of my college-educated parents had ever made in a year. More as a 25-year-old. And, you know, there were, you know, sacrifices had to be made so that I could go to Harvard College and Harvard Law School. You know, vacations were not taken and people didn't buy dresses and lots of things went in, you know, like for so many, lots of things went in to making me have that education. And I felt like I owed it to people to try to like making money. Mm-hmm. I didn't, But I thought I owed it. So my last Dev Voice thing is, so the way I quit, and Dev Voice is a great firm if you like that sort of thing. If you're into corporate law, it's a good place. But I quit because I'm doing a case, and I'm a junior person on the case, and it's an oil company I can't name, and Nigeria, and the oil company is doing horrible things in Nigeria, and I'm on the side of the oil company. Mm. And I was just like, man, the ancestors did not sacrifice, so I could be sitting here telling the Nigerian government how to just to take it, just to suck, right? That's not, like, whatever I'm supposed to be doing, it wasn't this. This was not the dream. I quit 2 weeks later. Like, from that epiphany, I quit about 2 weeks later.
14th Amendment, Section 3.
Ah.
Is there a practical way to use the 14th Amendment, Section 3, to get rid of the politicians who supported the January 6th insurrection?
Yes. So this question has come up a lot recently because people are trying to use it to exclude traitors, essentially, from running for office again, especially the orange traitor in chief. I will start here. This book I finished after January 6th, and still I didn't go into a big Section 3. That's how new this idea is in the scholarship and literature, right? So there's been a lot written about it in the last, like, year or so. But this is a relatively new thought and use of the amendment. So I don't want to say anything too aggressive. Is there a way? Sure. But who gets to decide if there's a way? The same six conservatives who currently control the Supreme Court. Right. So the 14th Amendment, the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, remember, this is coming after the Civil War, and so it basically says that anybody who held office but then kind of worked against the government could not hold office again. It was specifically kind of like, Jeff Davis, you're out, right? The former people who were in the Confederacy could run for office, but people who actually held office in the United States government and then abandoned that office to join the Confederacy, those were the people who were excluded. So a Donald Trump would be the guy that you're thinking about because he held office and then, you know, didn't do, arguably was part of the coup attempt. Again, I think it can work, but the problem that you always come back to is who gets to decide John Roberts and his cabal, right? So it's almost, I can answer that the same way that I answer term limits. Term limits are super popular, right? You look at Gallup polls. You know, lots of people want term limits on the Supreme Court, and there are all these crazy plans to figure out how to get term limits without needing a constitutional amendment to get term limits on the Supreme Court. And I love them all, but John Roberts gets to make the call. Mm-hmm. And I can't go to John Roberts' court and be like, I think all of you people should be much less powerful and expect to win. Right, and I think similarly, I don't know that I can walk into Roberts' court and be like, here, I can use this amendment, you know, novelly, to exclude Republicans, who appointed some of you, from running for office again, and expect them to agree.
Your opinion of Mitch McConnell and his influence on the Supreme Court, and how we are where we are today in regards to Supreme Court, primarily because Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and now he's going to be, it's a great possibility that in the next coming couple years, he's going to be the dominant speaker and control. He is a very insidious and...
the most dangerous man in America, and has been the most effective dangerous man in America for 10, 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. Specifically on the court, what he's done is that he understands that his party is unpopular. And I think that's what people forget sometimes. Like, there are Republicans who think that they're popular. They're not. They're just wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Like, their agenda and platform is massively unpopular. McConnell's kind of secret strength is that he knows exactly how unpopular and unlikable he and his people are. Mm-hmm. And so he's used the court because he knows that, because he knows that the court is the institution that is removed from the popular will. You can't vote a Supreme Court justice out. You can't move them out with the changing of the winds. He knows that once you get them on there, they're there for functionally ever, right? And are able to manipulate the laws and have a veto power on the other branches of government. So that's been his insight and his just brazen willingness to play hardball, and the Democrats tend to not be able to match his fire with fire. But I don't just blame Democratic politicians for that. I mean, I blame them somewhat because, you know, there's enough to go around. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also blame the Democratic base for that, because the bottom line is that you cannot win a Republican primary for president or Senate without being strong on the courts. Mm-hmm. Right? We all know that, right? Like, you cannot, like, think about, go back to 2016, Donald Trump, crazy man, oh, I'm anti-establishment, Mexicans are rapists, mm-hmm. I'm going to build a wall, like, crazy person. What about the Supreme Court? Oh, exactly the normal thing. Right? Like, all of a sudden, just, oh, no, just, where's my list from the Fed sock, and here you go, and I'm just a regular old person. We good? Okay, I'm back to crazy. Like, that's, that was 2016, right? Fast forward to 2020, Joe Biden is, you know, we got everybody running. We got Bernie Sanders running. We got the Coffee Man running. We got, you know, Mayor Stop and Frisk running. We got everybody running. Joe Biden is the most conservative person on the courts. Pete Buttigieg has a whole plan, 555, we're going to do, right? Bernie Sanders literally says, we could have 100 justices. I don't know. I don't care. I don't, right? Warren is interested in it. Biden's like, nope. Maybe a commission. Maybe. If you, right? Didn't cost him a vote. Did not cost him a vote. Certainly didn't cost him the nomination. And that is the asymmetry. Republicans, like I said, they go to the mattresses for this stuff. Democrats don't. And as long as Democrats don't, Democratic politicians won't act like that, right?
Why?
Like the person, like Sheldon Whitehouse gets it. Mm-hmm. And look, he was up for, he wanted to be chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Democrats went with the establishment guy, Dick Durbin. Not that Dick Durbin's bad, but like they didn't put Whitehouse in that job because Whitehouse wanted that job and he knows how to use that job. So like these kinds of things are part of the problem.
Hi, thanks for being here, Ellie. Love the. I'm only halfway through, but my question is really more. One of my favorite essays that you've written is the one where you talked about white people telling you about how you should respond to racism, and it shocked me. I have to say, I mean, I thought I was pretty good. I don't know when I read that, I thought, well, maybe I'm not, but I know a lot of really, really, really good people, good white people, who think they're doing the right thing, and I think I'm doing the right thing. But I know they're not, and I know we're not. I shouldn't say they. We're not always. Maybe we are. What do you need, you personally, because you can't speak for all black people, I know that. What do black people need from us? What is it that we can do on a daily basis?
So this is the ally question, which thank you for the question. I get that question a lot. What I and I appreciate you saying that you understand that I cannot speak for all black people because I can't, and it's important that you understand that I'm not trying to. Mm-hmm. However, what I generally need from an ally is for them to sound like me in the rooms where I ain't invited, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which, now, my white friends will attest to this, that's a pretty high bar when you're me, right? right? Like, because when I am invited into the room, the conversation goes sideways quick, right? And so when I'm asking my white friends and my white allies to sound like me, I'm asking them to sound like me. In, you know, the country club and in the, you know, parent PTA meeting and in the, right? And it's not easy for them. And they'll text me, and like I have text on my phone, white friends telling me, oh, this person is saying da-da-da-da. What should I say, Ellie? And I will tell them what they should say. Mm-hmm. And they will say, I can't say that. And I'm like, okay. Why? I would. But you're crazy. I'm like, all right, well, now next time we go out for drinks, I'm gonna yell at you. Like, right? But yeah, so that's for me, that's a particularly high bar, but that is my bar. Like, you know, because there are, you know, I'm not going to Thanksgiving dinner with these people. I'm not, you know, I'm not invited into these spaces all the time. I say that, you know, on TV too. I'm not, you know, I'm not in the executive suite with the people who make decisions on who gets shows or not, you know, on the television network. So if you're going to be my ally, you sound like I would sound when you're invited into that meeting, right? And it's a high bar, but it's what, you know, that's the bar. You know, and I just point out that, you know, as much as it's easy for me to say because I don't have, you know, attachments like that, you know, a lot of my black friends are also not as free as mm-hmm. I am, right? Like, you know, they have to be concerned about their mm-hmm. paper, about their job and their money and their, you know, positions. And yet, often enough, they will risk it all to tell that white man to go shut his damn mouth, right? Like you, and you can, if you've ever been in a meeting where you've seen like somebody else do this, you'll know what I'm, like you will see a black person like just making that calculation, like, is it all worth it? Because I'm about to lose everything just to yell at this man. And they're trying to like, just if you could just get up. Maybe I should be the one to leave the meeting so I can keep my, because like you're thinking, right? I've been, you know, again, my wife has a respectable job. And I've been in, you know, the Christmas party with her, and I'm like, oh, I need to leave. Because we have a mortgage, and we need to keep it, and right? So I understand that it's really difficult sometimes, but that's always the goal, right? That's the top ask, and if you get anywhere close to that, then we break bread and call ourselves friends.
And I think part of that too, if I may add, it's actually building the muscle. So you don't have to do Ellie Mistal out the gate.
Right?
Because I'm the dean of a law school. I'm not doing Ellie Mistal out the gate. But it's building the muscle and saying, today I'm going to say something. And then tomorrow I'm going to add a couple of more to that. And then by the end of the week, I'll have a full sentence. And I'll be able to back that sentence up with conviction.
I mean, I see it a lot, just to back it up. I see it a lot in my own life with women's issues, right? Where you're in the proverbial locker room, and you know the jokes are flying around and the things are flying around. It's like building the muscle, because it's exactly right to be the guy that actually speaks up. It's like we're not gonna do that joke, right? We're not gonna.
Yeah, did you really say that?
We're not gonna do that. We don't believe that.
You don't really believe that,
right? Like it's work, but yeah.
Yeah.
Really quick, what do you think about court expansion?
Court expansion.
Love it. Mm-hmm. Court expansion. The only thing that's going to work. I say plus 20. So the real quick answer to that is, I mean, people laugh. Right? I want to be like Hannibal Buress. Why are you laughing? I'm right. we should have 20 more justices. Who has 29 justices? That's the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals right now. So that's not too many. Mm-hmm. The benefit of 20 more justices, even beyond the revenge of just like screw these Republicans, is this. One, it makes it harder for Republicans to come back over the top. Like, you do four, Republicans are just like, when we get in trouble, we're gonna do five. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, I don't care. Just, I mean, we're down 6-3. If we go to 13-6 and the Republicans come back in and they go to 16-13, how is that worse? Mm-hmm. How is that worse than where we are? So I have no problems with Republicans coming back. But you put 20 on, and they got to put 40 on to get over your. It's a little bit higher bar for them to come back. So that's number one. Number two, it gives me something to trade, because then I can come to McConnell or whoever, and I say, look, I'm about to put 20 justices on the court. It's gonna be, right? It's gonna be 11-9, because what that nastiness that you did with Merrick Garland, we ain't forgetting. And we ain't forgetting alleged attempted rapist Brett Kavanaugh. Like, that just, those were some nasty things that y'all did, and we're not going to, so it's going to be 11-9. But you give me some votes, you give me some play, and it can be 11-9. You could have 9 of these 20 people, and we could have a bipartisan joint commission to make sure that of the 11 people that we pick, Ellie Mistal is not one of them. Like, whatever you want to do, like, right? Or you don't play ball, you don't give me any avoids. I'm going to put 20 of my most fire-breathing, crazy people on the court and see what you can do about it over the next, like, 4 or 5 years. So it gives me something to trade. Mm-hmm. And then the most important thing, people say they want moderate, mainstream, center-mass decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Well, how do you get that? Mm-hmm. If you ever tried to, like, figure out where you're going to go to dinner with, like, 5 of your friends, you might, you know, you might go to Thunder Down Under. Mm-mm. You might go to the club. Mm-mm. You might go. If you have to get your dinner together for 15 of your friends, you're going to go to Applebee's.
Right.
You're going to go to the Olive Garden. Right. Like, you're going to do a much more moderate thing if you have to get more people involved. If you have 29 justices and your majority opinion requires 15 people, that decision is going to be much more moderate, center mass, mainstream, inoffensive.
And concise.
And I'll be concise as well. I just would like you, if you could, to just double down a little bit on what you just stated to our friend here, the question about what do I do? And you said, represent me in those spaces where I'm not invited. And specifically, speaking to what's called the Batson effect, where just having one black juror, the studies show, has a tremendous effect on the jury of what's acceptable. You know, they don't just throw out all kinds of racist stuff. And that, so it just kind of shows, empirically how important that is. So if you could apply that to this so-called CRT debate, because where you have these board of educations where people are saying all kinds of crazy stuff and eliminating things like Toni Morrison. So this isn't just about, you know, the table discussion at Thanksgiving. Speak to that. Yep. And the need for white allies in this moment, mm-hmm. because I see that as political, because mm-hmm. they're trying to create the next constituency for Donald Trump and these kids.
Yeah. So my book became a critical race theory book as I was writing it. Like, I didn't know I was writing a critical race theory book, but then, you know, what white people changed the definition of critical race theory, and suddenly I was writing a critical race theory book. Who knew? What that debate is, and I've said this a lot of times, and it pisses some people off, and I don't know why. But what that really is white people being committed to making their kids dumb. I don't know why they want to do that. Because when it comes, you know, when my kid has to fill out his college essay to go to Harvard or Yale or whatever, my kid's going to know history. My kid's going to know who Abraham Lincoln is. My kid's going to know who Stokely Carmichael is. My kid's going to write it. It's going to be, yo, dumbass kid, who doesn't know these things and, like, gets out-competed by my kid and then whines about affirmative action. Like, why are you making your kids dumb? And so then when we talk about the allyship in this particular context, what I say to my friends is that all you have to do when you go to the school board meeting is advocate for your kids to be smart. You don't have to advocate for any particular racial whatever. Just advocate for your kids to be smart, because that's all that education should be. Just advocate for the school. Tell your kid the truth, and the rest will kind of play itself out. They're like, well, when do we don't want to expose our white children to the, you know, to how terrible slavery was before. I'm like, I gotta expose mine. Mm-hmm. Why is it okay for me to have to expose my kids to the truth, but not okay for you to have to expose your kids to the truth? Why is it okay for me to have to tell my kids what your grandmother did, mm-hmm. but not you can't tell your kids what your grandmother did? Like, how does that work, right? Again, if you want your kids to compete in a global world, then you should want them to know the truth about how history worked. In the same way that I want my kids to know the truth about American history, mm-hmm. I want my kids to know the truth about European history, mm-hmm. so we don't get these dumbasses being like, "I can't believe mm-hmm. there's a war in Europe." Yeah, mm-hmm. that's what y'all do. Mm-hmm. I want my kids to know the truth about Roman history, right? Like I want my kids to be smart. If you're a white ally, just ask for your kids to be smart.
Excellent. So I want to thank our hosts at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I want to thank the audience for being engaged. This is what it is to be in a democracy. The discourse, the resistance, the contestation for the liberation of the mind. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate you getting the book. It's very nice of you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.